From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Fashion and fashionability in 19th century France, this week on Soundings. My guest is Seema Godfrey of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Seema Godfrey worked on a forthcoming study entitled The Concept of Fashionability in 19th Century French Literature. Let's begin with a sort of general definition. What do you mean by fashion? We're talking, what, about 100 years ago, roughly?
Yeah, I'm dealing with a period that extends roughly from 1830 till the end of the Second Empire, or towards the middle of the 1870s in France. This is the period I'm concentrating on, although more generally I'll be extending both back and forward in time to look at this. And what we call fashion today is very much a product of the 19th century. It's a product of an emerging and quite powerful middle class, which has industrial wealth to compete with the former landed wealth of an aristocratic social structure. And it's also very much a product of the big city. We don't think of fashion as being a phenomena in rural areas or in the provinces. Before the 19th century, there was of course a sense of fashionability attached to royal courts, but basically dress was divided in two. There was the dress of the nobles, which became more or less uniform across Europe and in different regions, and there was the regional dress of the people.
Do you associate the notion of fashion with individuals, or do you hook it up with sort of philosophical or literary movements, that kind of thing? Maybe you're doing both.
It is linked to both. The interesting thing about fashion, and one of the ways that sociologists have looked at it in particular, and I'm thinking here of an essay by Georg Simmel, written around the turn of the century, is that fashion is one of those curious areas of activity that both combines people's desire to belong to a class, to identify within a group, as well as their need to differentiate themselves individually. And in the 19th century, when you're dealing with a relatively unstable social structure in terms of previous eras when classes had been more carefully and more specifically defined, you have a rather insecure emerging middle class that is trying, on the one hand, to imitate traces of an aristocracy which they are competing with, and to define themselves as a class of power and wealth, as well as differentiate themselves from commoner folk that they've now separated themselves from. And so it fulfills both those needs, to identify with a group, as well as to distinguish themselves socially from those they would like to consider beneath them.
And it all is, it's kind of hard to get a handle on. You know, again, when I ask you about individuals, can you be specific for me?
Well, the case of the designer is interesting, and that takes us right back to the period I'm talking about, because the Second Empire in France, that is the period from about 1852 to 1870, is the period during which the fashion industry as such emerged, and the character of the fashion designer, the couturier, who was first of all a man, which was quite remarkable at the time, but who was also in a position as somebody providing clothing, which previously had been a fairly humble assignment, to dictate to empresses and emperors how they should dress, the accessories to wear, and so on, and who had tremendous control over the courts of Europe, and by extension over the wealthy of the world, who set a certain tone.
We have the same thing today. We talk about Jacqueline Kennedy's dress designers. We talk about Nancy Reagan's hairdo expert, that sort of thing.
Right, and in fact, the first couturier was Charles Worth, who came from Britain to France in the late 1840s, and by 1858 he had opened the first house of high fashion, haute couture. And from all the reports I've read by various women who were dressed by Worth, they were delighted to have him control their appearance. And as a result, Worth considered himself not simply a merchant or a manufacturer. He began to think of himself as an artist who composed toilettes. And this idea of fashion as an art, which is a theme that runs through the literature of the time from a very different perspective. Here it took on a kind of industrial and pragmatic cast.
So we have the political connection. What about the relationship between fashion, fashionability, and the world of ideas? In the sense that, philosophers, you mentioned artists, mm-hmm. painters, mm-hmm. literary people, mm-hmm. would reflect it and express it?
Well, this is in fact the area that I'm most interested in. There are two questions here that overlap. One has to do with the history of fashion and the fashion industry, and the other has to do with the history of the concept of fashionability and how it emerges and how it's expressed in the 19th century. What first drew me to this subject was the fact, which is a rather curious one when you compare it to equivalent situations and themes in English literature, for instance, that so many of the 19th century literary authors we read, and I mean the most serious, the ones we consider part of the great canon, took a very serious interest in fashion. They described it, they enjoyed it, but they also theorized about it as a fact of the modern world. And one can start by simply looking at the novels of Balzac, who basically, in the long, detailed descriptions of dress, was in a way recognizing the manner by which fashion encoded changing relations of power and wealth in a society that was changing its own, whose structure was at the time very much in a state of flux. There is, in a sense, there is the emerging understanding that in this new society, clothes may in fact make the man, mm-hmm. and which is a kind of daunting thought.
You remind me of the chapters in Moby Dick that undergraduates customarily dismiss, all the descriptions of whales and all of that. They look at it and they say, well, this is just a lot of sort of biological detail. Why should I read this? And before our taping, you mentioned that it's not unusual for your undergraduate students to skip over 10 or 12 pages of descriptions of fashion, when in fact the writer is, Balzac in this instance, is really after something deeply cultural.
Oh, absolutely. In a sense, these long descriptions of the details of buttons and flounces and so on, which you find not just in Balzac, there are many other authors who use them as well. In a way, he's creating a persona. Mm-hmm. In his pages, in much the same way these people created their own public image through their manner of dress and asserted a kind of social presence uh-huh. that they may not have felt secure about otherwise. But beyond these kind of realist descriptions of dress that we find in the novels, you find poets also thinking a great deal about fashion and about the way that fashion is similar to what they do, to their poetry. Just as our students find these descriptions in the novels superfluous to the plot.
Right.
They want to go and look for the action.
It's not just ornament.
It's not just ornament, that's right. Yeah. We have a tendency, and one has a tendency in a generally materialist environment, to think of fashion and details of fashion and accessories rather frivolous, mm-hmm. As extravagant, as extraneous to more important things, to more useful things. And this is very much the way people thought of poetry as well.
Yeah.
And you find poets thinking and talking about fashion, about these wonderful, supposedly useless, superfluous flourishes that make humdrum existence more beautiful, as an analog to what they're trying to do as well.
What would be the object in this, Seema Godfrey? I mean, a poet would sit down and maybe not deliberately think, I'm going to write a poem that includes a lot of descriptive, flourishy language mm-hmm. about buttons or mm-hmm. Scarves or one thing and another. Would you connect it? I mean, is it can you be so crude as to connect it to an idea like honor or political behavior? Or mm-hmm. you got a lot of steps in between,
sure.
but help me to understand that.
Actually, I haven't made that clear. The poets I'm talking about didn't write poems about fashion. They wrote essays on fashion.
I see.
Which were actually essays about art and about beauty uh-huh. and how to be an artist in the modern world. And once they started thinking about what does it mean to be an artist, to be producing poetry or painting mm-hmm. in a modern world that is largely devoted to practical production and profit and industrialization, they touched on fashion as a kind of instance of something else that seemed to be superfluous, that was constantly changing, that seemed to defy at one level the values of the society around them through its complete uselessness, but which was very beautiful. And at the same time, it gave them a sense that just as fashion changes, art too needed to change to keep up with the modern, that one didn't have to stick to classical ideals of beauty at all costs, but that the real artist of the modern world would engage with the modernity around him, with changing conditions, and that the ideals of beauty could be revised for the to meet the circumstances.
In a way, you're talking about the rise of what we call popular culture, the connection between high art and low art, finding in what the apparently mundane or trivial or at least universal higher ideas, expressions of, again, fashion and fashionability.
Sure, there's a sense that the modern artist finds beauty in the street, but fashion was not popular at the time. What I'm talking about is something which is really should be called high fashion, and it really wasn't the domain of the popular, although it did filter down, obviously. This had to do with sort of the weekly production of new forms of appearance. And, for instance, Charles Baudelaire takes particular delight in an essay called The Painter of Modern Life, describing how the modern artist strolls through the streets, and his eagle eye glimpses these subtle changes that have taken place since the last week. Women's hairdos that have moved slightly down their neck, crinolines that have gotten slightly wider, ruffles that have gotten fuller, colors that have changed their hue. And that this is, in a sense, the way he captures the essence of the modern through these changing details.
Help me to understand the relationship between the 19th century artist and fashion, fashionability, and the larger society. We think of artists as subversives, free thinkers. Is there an element of that going on here at the same time?
There is, and this is what's so curious about it, because we, in at the one level, we think of people who strive to be fashionable as people who are trying very hard to be part of a certain social structure, to identify themselves with it. In the 19th century, from the 1830s on, there's a sense in which the artist begins to emulate the figure of the dandy in his extravagant fashion.
Beau Brummel, that kind of thing?
Beau Brummel becomes the hero for the French, absolutely. And they interpret him not as a conformist, but as an intellectual rebel. Here is a man who, in a world devoted to useful, practical production and commercial interests, chose to do nothing. He was not productive. He devoted his life to his own self and to beauty in his own self.
Art for art's sake.
It was art for art's sake and to a beautiful appearance and beautiful manner. And he was somebody who, by his very example, reversed the order of values of the beautiful and the useful, which is a theme that runs through this vaguely subversive discourse of 19th century artists. If the society at large was saying, above all, be useful, get rich, the artist was going to say, no, be beautiful, make beautiful objects, be useless. And the most dramatic statement of this comes from a writer who was very interested in fashion and described it at much length, and himself lived for a while the life of a dandy, Théophile Gautier, who wrote the Manifesto of Art for Art's Sake in 1834, in which he says that he is a man for whom the superfluous is necessary. And the example he gives from fashion is that a horsehair blanket will keep you just as warm as the most elegant frock coat from Staub, who is a famous designer. But you don't feel quite the same man to be a man and to feel your own sense of dignity and pride and superiority. Finally, you must adopt this sense of beauty about yourself.
It's a testament to the delicacy and the mutability of our notions of fashion and fashionability for us in the late 1980s to look back at Beau Brummel and say, well, that's a sort of curiosity of art. And yet you're telling me, Seema Godfrey, that that figure was taken very seriously
in the
19th century.
I think we have to separate the real man from the legend that he became in France, because he was, of course, the anecdotes about Brummel are delicious, and we take pleasure in the way he tended to send up the conventions of his own society through his manner, through his extravagance, through his wit, through his absolute charm. in the French tradition, starting from the 1830s, people started looking at him as more than just a fop, and a kind of amusing fop, and they theorized him into a model of a kind of subversive artist, somebody who by his very example was defying the conventions of a bourgeois society around him, by his absolute devotion to beautiful detail. And so the emulation of him takes place mostly in letters. You have a few artists who do try to live the life of a dandy for a brief while, but as always, the creditors come knocking and the bubble
is burst. Who would you be thinking about? Oscar Wilde, people like that?
That would be much later, and he certainly comes out of the tradition. I'm thinking in France of people like Théophile Gautier and Charles Baudelaire, mm-hmm. who wrote at great length about the dandy. For Baudelaire, as for many of these people, the dandy is a kind of a new breed of aristocrat, and the last incarnation of a certain kind of heroism in a world that has become irrevocably bourgeois, materialistic, commercial, mm-hmm. all of these things, defying the dominant values of his culture by asserting the importance of beauty and aspiring to higher goods.
Seema Godfrey, give me a couple of stories or anecdotes. You are looking at the literature of fashion and fashionability. Are there, characters in literary works or objects of poems or essays that come to mind?
Well, at the level of writers, probably the most startling example of a French author taking interest in fashion, and there are many of them, would be the example of Stéphane Mallarmé, who is perhaps the most difficult and certainly one of the most hermetic poets of the late 19th century. Very philosophical, very cerebral. And this man who wrote difficult, delicate, very beautiful, but very challenging poetry, took off a year in 1874 to write, edit, and publish a woman's fashion magazine on his own.
You mean something like Good Housekeeping or
what? More like Vogue magazine,
Vogue,
actually.
Okay.
He took on various persona. He would be Miss Satin, commenting on high life, and he took on the name of Marguerite de Ponty to talk about the latest fashions in Paris. This magazine provided fashion patterns, sewing patterns, in every issue. And so in a very literal sense, a fashion magazine, but tips on fashionable living, on interior decorating, on what was happening in the theaters in Paris, books to read. And in this sense, you see that culture becomes absorbed into the sense of fashionable things to do, the latest play, the latest book, in which he included books by authors that we consider very serious authors, Flaubert, Zola, Barbey d'Aurevilly, all these authors fell into this category of the latest thing to do. This is what's happening in our culture. And it's printed right alongside a detailed description of a new style of tea gown, which he talks about in great and accurate detail and with a great deal of pleasure.
Would people take this stuff literally? They would read this magazine and run right out and buy a dress or...
This magazine was bought on subscription, mm-hmm. and the readership was... This was not his literary readership. These were women in the provinces in Paris buying this, and to keep up on the latest details of fashion. It was very much a serious enterprise. The question is, as students of literature, how have we interpreted this little episode in Mallarmé's career? For the most part, historians have dismissed it as a curiosity, or assumed that he did it to make money, which in fact he didn't. And in any case, Mallarmé was very, very serious about his work, and he was engaged in a long and a difficult project, which he had to stop for a moment to do this. This was a serious and also a very amusing activity for him. He took great pleasure in describing and looking for the language to describe the effects of silk, the effects of jewels, all these flickering and intangible effects of fashion that created an aura of beauty. Mm. And in many senses, the descriptions he provides of the effects of dresses and fashions and women's accessories are not unlike the effects he tried to capture in his poetry of a very kind of fragile beauty that is and isn't there. In his poetry, he describes lace a great deal, feathers, all of these insubstantial and translucent objects that give us a sense of light and presence but aren't really there. And he found that in his descriptions of clothing as well. And so there's a much tighter relationship between the work he was doing in this journal, which was called The Latest Fashion, and in his poetry. These are not contradictory activities, they're complementary.
Are there writers or poets or thinkers today, Seema Godfrey, who you would find, in whom you would find a counterpart for Mallarmé? Or have we simply changed so much that that we don't crystallize it in the form of one person? We have, you know, again, we have our Bill Blass types and that sort of thing.
In France, I would have to answer for France. I can't think offhand of novelists or poets who are writing about fashion, although they're talked about in fashionable terms. And there are two instances that come to mind. The late Roland Barthes, the literary critic and, in a larger sense, cultural critic, at one point wrote a book called The Fashion System, where he applied to fashion the categories of analysis that one uses to look at literary texts. And these are quite wonderful analyses of different images from fashion and from fashion writing. He looks at the writing of fashion in fashion magazines. But at another level, we could think of something, a phenomenon like Vogue magazine, which again tries to project not just an image of being well-dressed, but of general sophistication and fashionability. And part of this involves reporting what's happening in Paris. And in the report from Paris, you'll get not just the latest coat designs or the latest color of shoes, but you get also the latest authors, the latest philosophers. And I'm always amused by finding things like an obituary for the French philosopher Michel Foucault in Vogue magazine, which was printed right alongside an ad for jewelry. And the ironically, the same words that were used to describe a pearl necklace were used to describe Foucault's writing, dazzling, brilliant, fashionable, sophisticated. And there's one common vocabulary that's used to talk about both of these phenomena. So in a sense, in America in particular, we have, in the past few generations in any case, been importing French culture, and this includes French philosophers, French writers, French artists, in much the same terms that we've been importing French lines of clothing. And there are seasons to the clothing, and there are seasons to the thinkers, and it falls into a larger category of being in fashion.
Just a quick footnote, Seema Godfrey, tell me about the bustle. That's a great story.
The most outrageous feature of women's fashion in the mid-century that I referred to was the crinoline. In the 40s, you had a very, very wide skirt on women's dresses, which was supported by many layers of petticoats, some of them made out of horsehair, padded horsehair, which is where the word crinoline comes from. The word crin in French means horsehair. And this clothing was very heavy and very uncomfortable. And so when the steel hoop frame, the crinoline, was created, this women were absolutely delighted, and the inventor made an absolute fortune in 4 weeks because this provided a lighter frame for these very, very wide skirts. And there were all kinds of dangers associated with these large skirts. For one thing, in most rooms, three women wearing these full dresses could not stand. And I mean, there are lots of anecdotes, and it was subject to much ridicule in its own time. But there were also catastrophes. The fabrics and the different layers of fabrics were combustible.
Oh, God.
And there were dreadful tragedies of women being burnt in these dresses.
They couldn't get out of them.
They couldn't get out. In one case, one German empress who had been caught smoking tried to hide her cigarette under her dress from her father, and of course the layers caught fire and she was burned to death. But there was an even more dramatic catastrophe in the cathedral in Santiago in 1863, where the drapery caught fire during a church festival, and the flames quickly spread to the light dresses of the congregation, and 2,000 women were burned to death. So there were terrible catastrophes associated with the crinoline. It became a social nuisance as well. One couldn't walk with it. Men could no longer give their arm to women when they were walking because it was too far away. We were dealing with a circumference of 12 yards around on these skirts. And it reached outrageous and proportions. Charles Worth was largely responsible for changing the shape of the dress, although it had reached its limit. It had reached an absolute limit of 12 yards and was no longer practical. And the Empress Eugenie herself became tired of this. And he slowly reshaped the skirt to gather it around to a bustle in the back. From this full form all the way around, it became narrow in the front, pulled up over the back into a bustle.
And what was the sort of philosophy of the bustle? What,
well, I don't know if the fashion designers themselves had a philosophy.
But the symbol.
In their case, it was mostly change, and it was to make women more comfortable. Uh-huh. Of course, their knees were now very bound together, and so their steps became more mincing. It was never comfort was never the real issue, although some people claimed that it was. But some of the moralists who looked at these various changes of fashion, and there were always moralists to complain about the excesses of fashion, saw in this change an image of decadence, which for them characterized Second Empire glamour and luxury generally. For the large crinoline dress did have one advantage for moral purposes. Women were definitely sedentary. You couldn't move around a lot. You certainly couldn't go running off.
Not to mention inaccessible.
And somewhat inaccessible. And there was a sense in which this full hooped skirt with large sleeves was a reflection of a rather sedentary life of a woman at home, in all her beauty and comfort, but very much at home.
And the bustle by contrast?
The bustle by contrast, and actually I shouldn't have said that the knees were bound. That came later. That was a later detail. At first, it was a fuller skirt on it. Allowed women to move, to walk more freely. And one moralist said that the bustle was designed for the woman to be seen in profile, not head on.
Right.
And that's because women have now are in the streets, and the only way we ever see them is whizzing by. They're leaving their families behind, and they've become passers-by in the streets, and that this is a sign of the decadence of the Second Empire. They're abandoning their families and taking to the streets. And this whole idea, of course, of women in the streets it smacks of a larger sense of immorality, which was tied into the fact, again, that you could no longer tell a noble woman from a courtesan, which was another cry that you heard a great deal.
Confusion not only of fashion, but of ideas.
Ideas and classes. And if I could read for you a commentary from one of these moralists about the bustle, this gives you a sense of how it was interpreted. All was reversed under the Second Empire. Family ties were relaxed, and a growing luxury so corrupted manners that an honest woman could no longer be recognized by her style of dress. The female toilette was transformed from head to foot. And I'll skip down here. The toilette became an image, he's talking about the bustle and the new hairdos, of the rapid movement which bears the world onwards and which threatens to carry away even the guardians of our homes. They are to be seen at this day, sometimes clothed and closely buttoned like boys, sometimes adorned with braid like soldiers, walking on high heels which throw them forwards, hastening their steps, cleaving the air, and hurrying their life as though to swallow up space, which in turn swallows up them. That's a statement by Charles Blanc, the founder of the Gazette des Beaux-Arts, in a book he wrote on art and ornament and dress.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about fashion and fashionability in 19th century French culture. My guest was Seema Godfrey of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Seema Godfrey worked on a forthcoming study entitled The Concept of Fashionability in 19th Century French Literature. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Fashion and French Culture, send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 402. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about American politics and the New Deal of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. My guests will be Alan Brinkley of Harvard University and William Lichtenberg of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Fashion and fashionability in 19th century France. This week on Soundings. Listen for a discussion featuring Seema Godfrey of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. From the novels of Balzac, to the poetry of Baudelaire, to the dandified figure of Beau Brummel, the uses of fashion and the concept of fashionability in 19th century French culture. This week, on Soundings.